Good morning, everyone. So this, as you know, is the third of the weekly office hours, the purpose of which is to enable each of you to ask any questions that come to mind concerning either the logistics of the course or the material covered previously in the course. There's no agenda. I'm just going to entertain questions, and the order in which they're presented, as always, the session will be recorded for the benefit of anybody who could not attend. So, as you likely remember, the procedure is either use the raise hand function in Zoom to put yourself in the queue, or write a question into the chat, and I'll do my best to answer it. Who wants to go first? No questions. So this will be an unusually short office hours. Sandisha.
Hello, Professor Fisher.
Hello.
Good morning. So my question is related to disclosure. So for example, there is an independent claim which has a certain element in its body, but it is not sufficiently, described, or say inadequate description is there in the written description or the specification part of the patent document. So can that be, held during the invalidity of that patent, or is it not sufficient?
Well, let's unpack the question a bit. As the recorded lecture indicated, there are several different overlapping but distinct dimensions of the disclosure requirement. One aspect of disclosure relevant to your question concerns claim definiteness. So all of the claims, both independent and dependent, have to be sufficiently precise to pass the claim definiteness test. And we will deal with that issue in more detail, not this coming week, which concerns newness, but the week after. The aspect of the disclosure requirements that seems most closely relevant to your question is, however, enablement. And the principle there is that every claim must be enabled by all the components in the patent, but most importantly, the specification. And that in turn means that a person having ordinary skill in the relevant art has to be able to practice the invention on the basis of the information provided in the specification. And that's true for every individual claim. So the enablement analysis is evaluated on a claim-by-claim basis. So every dependent claim and every independent claim has to be enabled in that sense. So that's the general doctrine, and that's common across jurisdictions. Not all aspects of the issue are resolved by that doctrine. And it's possible that in your seminars, you discussed the issue of enablement of genus claims. And the short answer there, short answer to a very long and complicated set of questions, is that the degree to which the specification must enable all of the embodiments identified in a genus claim remains contested. And it's a big and difficult issue involving antibodies. So to review, the general doctrine is clear enough. The general doctrine is enablement is assessed on a claim by claim basis. And that means that every independent claim and every dependent claim has to be enabled by the specification. But having identified the general doctrine, that still leaves open some edge cases, which are turning out to be economically and socially increasingly important.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Pablo.
And good morning for everyone. Good morning, Professor Fisher. When we talk about for the case of fingerprints, how we could explain the analogous arc for a previously academic investigation that could conceive that this fingerprints could not accomplish the enzymes and the substantial characterization of that curve appeals in consolidate first. And the second, Professor Fisher, how we could explain the motivation in the requisite of obviousness inside the KCR Intel code Viteleflex Inc. How we could understand the teaching suggestion or motivation test that could inspire that case. Thank you very much, Professor.
Okay, so I'll answer this second question. I may need a little bit more clarification on your first one, but here's the answer to the second question. Prior to the KSR decision in the United States, the Federal Circuit had adopted a variety of guidelines for assessing non-obviousness that were very friendly to patentees. And one of those guidelines was that the challenger to the validity of a patent on the basis of non-obviousness had to be able to identify in the prior art some teaching suggestion or motivation that would have moved a person having ordinary skill to combine components of the prior art to create the claimed invention. And if you couldn't, as a challenger, identify such a teaching suggestion or motivation, you would lose. A flag for the future here is if you're curious about what such a teaching suggestion or motivation might look like, there's a good chance that in your seminars this coming week, the SRAM case, which involves bicycle chain rings, will come up, and you'll have some illustrations there of what such a teaching suggestion or motivation might look like. So back to the doctrine. What the Supreme Court did in KSR with respect to this teaching suggestion or motivation requirement was reduce its importance. Whereas for the Federal Circuit, it had been a requirement. And in the absence of a identification of a teaching suggestion or motivation that the challenger would lose, The Supreme Court said, no, that's too demanding on challengers. And instead, the presence or absence of a teaching suggestion or motivation is merely a factor to be taken into account along with a whole bunch of other factors. So the result was to make it somewhat easier after KSR to challenge patents on non-obviousness grounds. And partly as a result, the frequency of successful challenges goes up after KSR. So that's a response to your second question. Now, I'm afraid you're going to have to restate your first one because I was a little unclear what exactly you were asking. So can you do it again?
Yes. What do you think about the analogous arts implementation of the academic file? I mean, what the Court of Appeals review for implementing the Toyota case?
Well, I think the analogous arts issue is a good illustration of the ambiguity and difficulty of applying the US methodology on non-obviousness. And in particular, it continues to attribute to a person having ordinary skill in the art unrealistically broad knowledge of what's going on in related fields. That's true in Toyota. I'm not sure whether you have encountered in your reading the Nabisco case, but similarly there, my view is that too much credit is given to a FOCITA by the US approach. And in this respect, the European Patent Office's approach, which does not identify a zone of analogous art and instead concentrates attention upon the closest prior art, is more realistic. Now, to be sure, the EPO's approach has problems of its own, but at least it's not susceptible of this particular criticism. Byron.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Professor Fisher, and good morning, everyone. I would like to know your opinion about the enablement as the fourth element for granting a patent. Do you think that we could consider this as an important requirement for granting a patent as a fourth requirement aside non-obviousness, novelty, and utility? This could be the fourth element?
Yes. And that's true of pretty much every jurisdiction in the world. So the four elements, as you point out, are utility, disclosure, novelty, and inventive step. This past week, everything was about utility and disclosure. This coming week, the recorded lecture and the seminars will be examining the other two requirements, novelty and non-obviousness. Those are the four and the only four. Now, they vary in the frequency with which they arise in litigation and the difficulty of surmounting them. Generally speaking, utility is easy in most circumstances to satisfy. And as a result, it rarely arises in litigation. The only major exception to that, as discussed in the recorded lecture, is circumstances in which what a discovery does at all is unclear, like the fragment of a gene or a new chemical compound, and whether it has any use at all. Okay, that's a context in which utility can be successfully challenged. But in most jurisdictions now, it just doesn't come up. Disclosure is the next in order of ease of satisfying. Usually what's at stake here is skill of the drafter of the patent application. If you have a reasonably skillful drafter, it's pretty easy to satisfy the disclosure requirement, with the one exception of the genus claims issue. The two hardest requirements to satisfy are the two that are coming up for this coming week. That's novelty and non-obviousness. And of those two, the last one, non-obviousness, otherwise known as inventive step, is by far the most often successfully asserted as a challenge to patenting. So a great deal of litigation is focused on interpretation of the inventive step requirement. That's really where most of the action comes down to, and that's where most of the inter-parties review proceedings concentrate. So those are the only four. Now, just to remind you by way of review, before you get to the four requirements, you do have to satisfy the subject matter issue. You have to demonstrate that what you are seeking protection for falls within the zone of patentable subject matter. Until recently, that was a trivial requirement because pretty much everything satisfied it. Now, especially, but not exclusively in the United States, it's a little bit harder than it used to be. So stepping back from the details here and review, number one, you have to show that what you're seeking protection for falls within subject matter. And then you have to show utility, disclosure, novelty, and non-obviousness. And the ease of satisfying them is in that order, easiest to the hardest. So in the chat, Allison asked a quick administrative question. Would you mind clarifying? I saw that the module 104 lectures have changed on the website in the last day. Am I correct that the former 104A is now the optional lecture? The answer is yes, that's true. So apologies on that front. It's not a good idea for me to be modifying the recorded lectures within 2 days of the time when you'll be discussing them. So a confession here is I spent the long weekend with my grandchildren in California, and I'm a little behind in populating the website. So that's the source of the understandable question asked by Allison. So this is just for everybody else's benefit. Looking forward, the required recorded lectures for this coming week are the short lecture on a comparative assessment of novelty. It's 20 minutes long. And the long lecture on the inventive step requirement. It's about 40 minutes long. Those are the two that are required. Now, if you're really eager to explore the details of novelty in the United States, then the recorded lecture that's labeled on the website optional is there. It's an intriguing to me. If you are, as they say, a patent nerd, you will find novelty fun, but most people don't. And so why is it optional? After all, if it's the US approach, why do we have it? Why do I include it at all? Well, the answer is a fair amount of litigation happens in the United States, but that's why I include it at all. The reason I identify it as optional is that, as some of you already know, every other country in the world has now rejected the US approach on novelty. And the US itself is coming round to the principles applied in other jurisdictions. So on this particular issue, the US is an outlier. That's not true of the inventive step requirement, but it is true of novelty. So apologies again for the administrative confusion. Anne.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I had a question about the Federal Circuit case from this week's reading, the Chambers v. Dakin case. Mm-hmm. And my question is that in reading through this, I felt like identified more with the dissenting opinion. And I have not admittedly gone back to look at the patent files to kind of, you know, come to my own decision and also the prior art that was cited. But in reading again what was cited in this case, I'm wondering what kind of subtleties I may have missed with respect to the obviousness and the kind of teaching away concept.
The short answer to that question is no, you haven't missed any nuances. So as you probably know, given the sophistication of your question, the purpose of assigning Federal Circuit cases pedagogically is usually to identify issues that are on the borderline. And that's true in the decision that you identify. So I happen to agree with you. I think dissent is more persuasive on this issue. So why didn't it prevail? Well, because there are different panels on the Federal Circuit and they tilt back and forth. So no, you haven't missed anything. Going further down this road, however, I think would be not optimal for this particular office hours, because you haven't yet had a chance to explore in your seminars the different methodologies and to juxtapose the Federal Circuit's approach with the European Patent Office. So if after the seminar this week you're still uncertain on the score, and if you have time next week, come back to the office hours and we talk about it again. So the short and probably unsatisfactory answer is no, you haven't missed anything and shouldn't be troubled by the fact that you thought you were inclined to find the dissent more persuasive.
Okay, well, that's really helpful information. Thank you. Yeah, I was just looking at that sort of in light of 21, you know, MPEP 2123. And so that's where that's kind of why I was curious about, you know, if there was something else that was missed. I have one other question as well, if there's time for that.
Yep.
And that is that I was wondering, I saw that a recent decision came out, Chromadex v. Elysium, that has to do with subject matter eligibility. And I was wondering if you, I don't know if you've had a chance to look at this yet, but it's around.
No, okay. I haven't. Okay. So, but I will actually, that's a good nudge. I will check it out and get back to you on that.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Mateo.
Good morning, Professor. Thank you for your time always. So I have two questions. I don't know if I misunderstood you in the past seminars that you told us that the patent system was shrinking. I think you say that, or the applications are decreasing. So I want you to explain me that first. And second, do you think that now with the artificial intelligence, the novelty will have more scrutiny, ergo is going to be more difficult to satisfy this requirement? Thanks.
So I should clarify with respect to the first question. When in the second lecture, I indicated that the coverage of the patent system is shrinking. What I mean by that is that since 2000, in some jurisdictions, including the United States, the zone of patentable subject matter has contracted. And in particular, more applications for the protection of software patents and naturally occurring genetic sequences will be rejected on subject matter grounds now than was true 20 years ago. So it's in that sense that the ambit or scope of patent law has shrunk, not in the sense of how many applications are being filed. So in every, or at least every major jurisdiction in the world now, which includes the United States, European Patent Office, China, Japan, and Korea, the numbers are going up and will continue to go up. They are going up at different rates. They're going up fastest in China, but in every jurisdiction, they're rising. And that, for better or worse, is a pretty good indication of the of the increasing importance from a business standpoint of patent protection. Now, remind me of your second question.
Do you think that with the AI, the artificial intelligence, the authority will have more scrutiny? Ergo, is going to be more difficult to satisfy this requirement? Yeah. You know that the engines now that, well, back in the days, it was one guy looking information in all countries. Uh-huh. And now artificial agents can do it, I don't know, in seconds, maybe minutes. So you think that this requirement is going to be have more scrutiny?
So, yeah, that's an interesting question. It's certainly true that technology is facilitating novelty challenges. Ordinarily, the scrutiny by the patent office of novelty is fairly cursory. The examiner will be checking out reasonably easily searchable databases of relevant material. And whatever the applicant has identified as relevant prior art, but will not be making an extensive investigation. By contrast, when either in inter partes review or in litigation, a challenger is trying to invalidate either a claim or the patent at large, that challenger will do a very extensive search for prior art. And in making such an extensive search, technology is increasingly helpful to the challenger, not to the patentee, by facilitating ever more comprehensive and text-based searches of ever-expanding bodies of information. But that's not artificial intelligence. That's just searching. Artificial intelligence raises different issues. So roughly speaking, artificial intelligence involves circumstances in which a programmer creates software designed to derive guidance in solving a problem from a large database of analogous information. And the reason why it's referred to as intelligence is that the programmer cannot give the program complete guidance concerning how to process the database. And as a result, the program will generate unexpected results and will be building an algorithm for making decisions that was not crafted by the programmer. Now, that raises very interesting questions that have come up previously in the office hours concerning who's the inventor of something that pops out at the end of this sequence. So in that sense, artificial intelligence is a significant challenge in the patent field, as it is in the copyright field. But it doesn't generate greater command of prior art. It's generating new things. That's the thing, that's the aspect of artificial intelligence that's intriguing and challenging, not its capacity to identify prior art. So to review, technology, search technology, is definitely helping challengers, but not artificial intelligence. That raises a different set of issues.
I was thinking in the Fosita, right? So I'm trying to look in the future, and he's going to have more tools than now. So I'm thinking, I don't know, 1-2 years, there's going to be like a search engine for information of prior art for the Fosita. So that's why I'm thinking, like, maybe the novelty requirement is going to be going to have a high standard to pass it to satisfy the requirement. Not that the artificial intelligence is going to make the job of the Fosita and say this is not accomplished with the novelty requirement. I mean, like, the Fosita is going to have more information about the prior art, so it's going to be more difficult to pass it. I'm just thinking in the future.
Yeah, I see. Okay, that's conceivable, but the relevant doctrine will not be novelty. That'll be inventive step. In other words, it's conceivable that artificial intelligence will, as you suggest, become sufficiently readily accessible and common and routine that one would expect a person having ordinary skill in the relevant art to be employing artificial intelligence mechanisms to be, as you suggest, looking more widely in fields of analogous art in order to find guidance for solving the problem at hand. So the result will be to charge this hypothetical person, the Fosita, with wider command of information than is true today. Yeah, that's possible. If so, it will highlight the divergence between the European Patent Office approach and the US approach. Because the US approach, used by many other jurisdictions as well, puts a fair amount of emphasis on the identification of the ambit of the analogous arts. Whereas the EPO's approach focuses on identifying the closest prior art element and then indications in the body of literature concerning how one might spring, is the metaphor used in the EPO, from that closest prior art to solve the technical problem presented by the invention and that the invention is designed to address. So because the EPO approach places a premium on identifying a single piece of prior art, the possibility you identify that artificial intelligence would expand the zone of analogous arts less relevant. So bottom line is, if the trend that you suggest does indeed come to pass, it will increase the divergence between the analysis of inventive step under the US approach versus the EPO's approach.
Thank you.
Welcome. Okay, back to the chat for a moment. Anne helpfully identified a link to the relevant Federal Circuit decision. Yes, I'll definitely get back to you on that. Okay. Could you kind of next, then a friend says, could you share your opinion and concern about the Department of Justice increased prosecution of economic espionage and IP theft, particularly with China? Is this purely political? Are there any negative ramifications of these actions? Okay, so this is an interesting question. It's very different from the kinds of questions we've been addressing thus far, but these are office hours and anything is up for grabs. So there are two controversial issues raised by Efren's inquiry here. The first is, to what extent is economic espionage, especially by organizations, governmental or private in China, happening? And the second is, if it's happening, what are the implications of the U.S. Department of Justice's pursuit of these instances? So there's a lot of debate, as you undoubtedly know, about on the first question, to what extent is it happening? My view is, yes, it's definitely happening. Meaning that there are ongoing efforts by enterprises in China to ferret out advanced technologies in other jurisdictions, including but not limited to the United States. Now, notice that this is not directly relevant to patents. It's related to trade secrets, because patent law requires more or less the revelation to the world of the technical information in question, and therefore economic espionage is irrelevant. But trade secrets, the alternative approach to maintaining control over one's technology, does implicate economic espionage. So it's happening. Is it increasing or decreasing? Tough to say. Generally speaking, what has happened over the last 10 years is that private enterprises in China have become increasingly sophisticated in the sense of becoming innovators. That's true in information technology, it's true in biotechnology. And so the a world in which Chinese enterprises were dependent upon obtaining access to innovations pioneered in the United States and Europe, they were pretty well past that. And indeed, with respect to many other sectors of the world, Chinese enterprises are now leading as the front. Okay, so it's happening. How common is economic espionage from China? Very tough for me to say, but my overall impression is it's the motivations for engaging in economic espionage are going down, not up, because of the increasingly innovative posture of Chinese enterprises. Okay, that now we turn to the second question. Well, what about the Department of Justice's actions here? Well, to the extent that the Department of Justice is trying to identify genuine instances of true espionage, I think it's entirely appropriate. It's a effort to enforce general principles of trade secret law that are economically and socially justifiable. However, there is one aspect of what the Justice Department has recently done that's much less defensible, and that involves going after academics in the United States, typically professors of physics or chemistry or biology, who have been engaged in collaborations with enterprises in China. That's socially problematic because cross-border collaborations are beneficial. And to the extent the Justice Department's action is chilling them, it's bad from a social welfare standpoint. And it also tends to be symbolic in the bad sense. It's a manifestation of firmness in dealing with the Chinese threat, meaning that's the way things are characterized. So it's part of the posturing of governments. It's of a piece with shooting down balloons whenever they come over your territory. Some balloons undoubtedly are engaged in not economic espionage, but political espionage and shouldn't be there. But now we seem to be in the business of shooting down anything that shows up over the edges of the country. And that's primarily driven by symbolic efforts to demonstrate firmness. And as I say, to the extent it's applied to pursue academics who are collaborating across the borders between the United States and China, it's socially pernicious. So that, for what it's worth, is my view on that score. Efren, do you want to follow up on this? No. Okay, well, let me know if you do. Then a question up here, yes. How, an administrative question, how do we access the recorded office hours discussions? Yeah, that's a good question. I haven't addressed that yet. There are a couple of different administrative issues that are outstanding, and this is one of them. So I will be adding to the website for the course at the bottom of the page a link to repository for the recordings. Okay, back to live questions here. Ismail.
Thank you very much, Professor. Thank you for your time. My question relates to the working of patents. You shared a link covering the interview with Ms. Vatal, and I listened to it, and it was very useful. But I want to ask, should importation of patents be accepted as a working of a patent? Some countries, during the interview I heard, as far as I understood, Brazil, for example, still have such a provision in its law. There's a contradiction between the TRIPS Article 27 and this condition. Thank you. I hope you get my question. Thank you.
I do. Yeah, it's a good question. So with respect to the compatibility of different interpretations of the working requirement with the TRIPS agreement, I can't do any better than Joshua Wattal. She's her guidance on that is in part because she was involved in the drafting of the relevant agreement as good as I can't do any better. But you asked a different question. You asked the question of should importation be deemed sufficient to satisfy a working requirement? Yeah, this depends a lot on what you think the purpose of the working requirement is. So if the objective of a working requirement is to ensure that the embodiments of the invention are commercially available in the relevant jurisdiction, then the answer is surely yes, that importation should be enough to satisfy the working requirement because imported products definitely make the product commercially available. Second option. If the purpose of the working requirement is to make sure that embodiments of the innovation are available at affordable prices in the relevant jurisdiction? Well, not necessarily then, because if the putative patentee seeks to satisfy the working requirement by making available the innovation at high prices, well, it's plainly not addressing the underlying concern. And that has obvious relevance to our ultimate focus in this course on the global health crisis, that some jurisdictions, Brazil would be an example here, are primarily interested not just in ensuring that drugs, like HIV drugs, are available commercially in Brazil, but also that they're available commercially in Brazil at affordable prices. And in its famous and successful fight with the United States over the working requirement, that was Brazil's objective, was to drive prices down. And so Brazil was adopting a more demanding interpretation of work than mere importation. The status of Brazil's insistence from a legal standpoint remains uncertain because the parties never pressed it to an authoritative resolution. But that was definitely the position of Brazil, and it was ultimately successful in the sense that the pharmaceutical firms retreated and the HIV drug prices dropped in Brazil, and Brazil was remarkably effective in meeting the challenge of HIV faster than was true in sub-Saharan Africa. Okay, there remains a third possibility. So possibility number one is, to review, what are you trying to achieve? Well, just make sure that the product is available in the country. Option number two is, the goal is to make sure that the embodiments are available at affordable prices. Option number three is capacity building, that increasingly now, developing countries, especially but not exclusively in Africa, are concerned to interpret the patent system in a way that will ensure not merely that patented products are available there, but that there is domestic capacity to not just manufacture, but to develop new drugs. That's the goal of the working requirements. And this is a part of a general project of increasing local production of pharmaceutical products, but not limited to production. It's also encompassing innovation in the pharmaceutical field. If that's the goal, then importation is definitely not adequate to satisfy the concern. Instead, what South Africa and Kenya are interested in is using this lever to get plants built locally, like the plant that was built in Uganda. So the answer to your question is a complicated one. Draw this to a nub here, whether importation should be adequate to satisfy a working requirement depends on what you think the purpose of the working requirement is. And increasingly now, developing countries are aspiring to adjust patent law so as to facilitate capacity building. And the working requirement is a piece of that. Pablo, back to you.
Thank you, Professor. As Byron and Mateo talk about, Byron referred for requirements, and Mateo talk about the artificial intelligence on the on one requirement that is novelty. But my question is how we think about the public consultation of the USPTO that yesterday confront inside the attorneys of United States that want to know about co-inventors of AI inventions. That's the movement that replies what is talk about the AI inside a new requirement of patent system, or as I said the last week about the Davos case, is a consultation that is in place in the background of the attorney Ryan Abbott, that is the attorney that make the requirement inside South Africa, Australia, European Union, and United States. But my question is, how the academic file inside of the universities of the United States concern about this public consultation about the USPTO? Because it can say that the patent next course would change, would change inside that COVID-19 in public system. That's another priority that could revolve all the system that patent statutory based in United States. Thank you.
If I understand correctly, this is a very difficult, big question. Within every, well, within most, not every, national government, there are several major administrative bodies, administrative and legislative bodies, with interests in the shaping of the patent field. And they're not limited to the patent office. So let's take the United States here. There's the USPTO, obviously, has an interest in not just running the patent system, but influencing its shape. But there's also the United States Trade Representative, which is typically engaged in efforts to induce, one way or another, other countries to tighten their patent regimes, to make them more like that in the United States, and to renounce exceptions and limitations that could be employed to soften the grip of the patent system. On the other side of the ledger, there are organizations within the US government that are pressing in the opposite direction. That would include USAID and its current leader, Samantha Power, who are primarily interested in assisting developing countries in meeting economic and health challenges, and to the extent that implicates intellectual property rights, they press for softening rather than hardening. So you raise the question, well, how do academic consultations play in this complicated dynamic? It's a little indeterminate. It definitely plays. So be concrete here. The predecessor of this course, the Copyright X course, has had some spin-offs in providing advice to developing countries concerning their ongoing processes of modifying the copyright system. When the United States Patent and Trademark Office has become aware of those initiatives, They've generally speaking been skeptical because they think that the guidance that we've been giving is insufficiently protective. Conversely, to take an example closer to home, USAID, including the director, Samantha Power, is quite supportive of PatentX, this initiative right here, on the grounds that increasing knowledge of the, not just the structure of the patent system, but also the tools within it to respond to crises is, broadly speaking, a good thing. So the role of academic discussions, including educational initiatives like this one, in the shaping of the relevant systems is very complicated, in part because, as I say, the players within each government who have a stake in the shape of the system are more diverse than the patent offices. They're more critical actors than the patent offices alone. So I think that's enough to address, I think, for the time being. But you may well want to re-raise this issue at the end, because thus far, as you know, we're only a third of the way into the course, and thus far we've been dealing, I've been trying to provide you increased awareness of how the patent system works and where the levers are for adjusting it. And we haven't yet harnessed that methodology to addressing the global health crisis. That only begins, 3 weeks down the road. And that's going to be the more controversial dimension of the course. And so we'll come back to your issue later when we've put these tools to work on the global health crisis.
Thank you very much, Professor.
You're welcome. Okay, then I'm just turning to the chat here for a moment. Arnell, asked, from the USPTO website, it states that the right conferred by the patent grant is, in the language of the statute and of the grant itself, the right to exclude others from making, using, offering for sale, or selling the invention in the United States, or importing the invention in the United States. What is granted is not the right to make, use, offer for sale, sell, or import, but the right to exclude others. Can you explain this point? I'm a bit confused with that, because my understanding is the right to exclude others. Okay, this is a good question. In 3 weeks, when we turn to the topic of infringement, we'll address this directly, but it seems appropriate to talk about it now as well. Patent law is very different from copyright law on this particular axis. So the copyright system gives, in every country in the world, a copyright owner the exclusive right to engage in certain activities. Reproduce the work, prepare derivative works, distribute it, and so forth. The PTO's website, the relevant passage that you quote, is, not surprisingly, correct, that the patent system is different. The patent system does not give the patentee the right to do anything. Rather, the patent system gives the patentee the ability to block others from engaging in particular activities. So why does this matter? Well, in most circumstances, it doesn't. the exclusive right to engage in an activity is functionally the same as the ability to prevent others from engaging in the activity. But there is one circumstance in which this difference does matter, and it involves improvements. So suppose that, well, I'll take a real example. Suppose that I invent a air brake for trains, which help trains slow down more effectively. And because the technology facilitates braking, it allows trains to be longer because they have more effective braking power. And then you, Armel, invent an improvement on my air brake. If I get a patent on my air brake and you get a patent on your improvement on the air brake, this creates a situation known as blocking patents. I can't practice your improvement because you have a patent on it. And you can't practice your improvement because you can't practice it without building one of my air brakes, which I have a patent on. Each of us is in a position to exclude or block the other. So this might sound terrible. It creates a kind of stalemate in which nobody can build and sell the improved air brakes. But in practice, that's not what happens. What happens is that we will cross license. We'll do a deal in which we will authorize each other to make and sell the improved air brake, and we will share the enhanced revenue in some way. Now, exactly how the revenue will be divided will depend on how effective we are in negotiating. But the central point is that this characteristic of the patent system sometimes produces so-called blocking patents, in which both of two parties can prevent the other from engaging in an activity, but neither has alone an exclusive right to do anything. And under those circumstances, although paralysis is possible, in practice, that's not what occurs. In practice, what occurs is cross-licensing and sharing of revenues. Peter.
Good morning, Professor. So I have a question about enablement. Mm-hmm. I came across the Amgen v. Sanofi case, which is about full scope. And one of the things that they talk about there is whether enablement is a question of law or a question of fact. And I'm not quite sure what that means. So I was wondering what the difference of that is and what the implications of on.
Yeah.
If it's a question of law or if it is a question of fact.
Yeah. So that is a good example of a aspect of the relevant doctrines that makes a big difference in the United States, but doesn't make a big difference in most other jurisdictions. The reason it makes a big difference in the United States is that on issues of fact, juries have more power to resolve the issue than do courts, and B, appellate courts have to defer to findings by lower courts more commonly than they do on issues of law. Generally speaking, issues of law reviewed so-called de novo, whereas issues of fact, decisions on issues of fact are reviewed using a more deferential standard. So as a result, in all fields of law in the United States, there's an obsession with how one classifies a particular topic. When we get in week 7 to remedies, you're going to see several illustrations of this with respect to how damages are organized. So what's the answer vis-a-vis enablement? Well, this is going to be unsatisfying, but enablement is a mixed question of law and fact, meaning that the determination of the relevant rule is definitely a matter of law. So the issues at stake in the Amgen case involving genus claiming are matters of law, and they have to be settled by the courts. But the question of whether a particular specification has enough information to enable a person having ordinary skill in the art to practice one of the embodiments at issue, that's a matter of fact on which a finding by a lower court will be deferred to by an appellate tribunal. Suad.
Yes, Professor. Hello, all. Perhaps my question is a little far from the content of this module, but actually it is a question that is raised in a discussion that took place this week. And I hope to hear you, to hear from you, Professor, about it. We know that the right granted by the patent to its owner is to prevent others from exploiting the patented invention in any way, including importing the invention. My question here is related to exhaustion and parallel importation. Should the law provide for allowing exhaustion in general and the international exhaustion in particular, so that we can conclude that the state or the country allows its implementation, and that is the important, the importer is not responsible for, doesn't have any legal liability if he imports the invention from another country, provided at a lower price in his own country? And does this also require that the country supplying the invention protected by a valid patent adopt the same condition in its law, so that the whole matter of exporting and importing is done legally?
Okay, this is a great question. It's another, it's an example of a question that we will be taking up in much more depth twice in the course. Once in week 6, when we talk about infringement, and once in week 8, when we talk about possible modifications of the intellectual property system dealing with drugs. So it's going to come back up. But it's a fair question for office hours, so I'll give you a preliminary response. Facilitating, well, back up, a background issue here. As you know, from the presentation by Joshua Watal, the TRIPS agreement is designed to and does limit the ability of each country in the world to adjust its patent system in many ways, but not, interestingly, with respect to parallel importation. There was no agreement in the drafting of the TRIPS, there was no consensus in the drafting of the TRIPS agreement concerning how parallel importation should be managed. And so Article 6 of the TRIPS agreement leaves this up to each country. So this is an area that's sometimes known as one of the TRIPS flexibilities. This is a topic that each country can decide for itself. Now, things get complicated because, as you point out, there's both an exporting country and an importing country, and the feasibility of parallel importation depends upon the rules in both of them. Okay, put that to one side. Let's focus on the substantive issue that you mentioned. Should the exhaustion rules be adjusted so as to enable parallel importation or not? The usual answer to that question from the standpoint of consumers is yes, parallel importation facilitates the ability of consumers in every jurisdiction to gain access to drugs or other products at the lowest possible prices. And so it's a good thing from a social welfare standpoint. To that argument, there are two responses. The first is that you have to always be careful when adjusting the rules of patent law to preserve the incentives for innovation in the first instance. So every time you make an adjustment in the knobs of the patent system that benefits consumers, you have to worry about its aggregate effect in reducing the potential flows of revenue to the patentee. Okay, that's one reasonably obvious general point. Here's the more subtle one. Patentees can make more money if they engage in differential pricing, and specifically geographic differential pricing. If they charge more, say, in the United States and Western Europe than they do in, say, Bolivia or Malawi. And differential pricing is not only profitable for the patentee, it's beneficial to the residents of poorer countries because it enables them to gain access to products at lower prices. So presumptively, this isn't a complete answer, but it's a first cut. Presumptively, you want to organize the patent system so as to facilitate differential pricing, especially, but not exclusively, with reference to drugs. So how do you facilitate differential pricing? By preventing parallel importation, because parallel importation is a form of arbitrage that corrodes differential pricing. So if your goal is to make sure that drugs are available or other products are available at the cheapest prices in Bolivia and Malawi, then you should oppose rather than favor an interpretation of the exhaustion rules that will facilitate differential pricing. Okay, now, as I say, this is not the end of this analysis. There are some objections to this maneuver, and some of them are quite powerful, but I think I'm just going to wait until the two other times when this issue comes up in the course to pursue it further. Byron.
Thank you, Professor. You talk about capacity building, and I would like to know your opinion about how we could address this capacity building in developing countries like Bolivia, Ecuador, or some other countries regarding this patent system. What we could see at the universities is that universities are reinventing the wheel when they try to investigate something, and they are very far from the state of the art, and that is very frustrated for people in our country. We are very far from the latest technologies, and how we could create this capacity building environment to improve our research and development in universities or in the private sector. What do you think about the strategies that we could apply for that?
Yeah, a very good question. Well, I'll give you two answers. There are lots of things one could do, so this is not going to be a complete response, but here are two possibilities, both of which we'll also be discussing later in the course. Possibility number one is to organize the legal system in a way that encourages the formation of triangles. What's a triangle? A triangle includes at one corner the a firm, typically a holder of both a patent and lots of proprietary know-how, typically in the United States, Japan, or Western Europe. That's one corner. Second corner is a manufacturer located in a developing country, capable of producing the product at issue. And the third corner is the government of the developing country, which commits to purchasing products manufactured by the local manufacturer. So this has happened with some frequency in the past, not super often. Has happened in Uganda, is currently happening sort of in Mozambique, definitely has happened in some Latin American countries. The advantage of triangles of this sort is that the government of the country in question, by committing to purchasing products from the local manufacturer, provides a substantial incentive for the holder of the technology to participate. And the result is that by building a plant and then supplying the technicians to educate potential workers in the plant, you build at a minimum manufacturing capacity in the country in question. And manufacturing capacity tends naturally to move to produce innovative capacity. So an example would be Intel in Costa Rica. The presence of a big plant not only provided a whole bunch of skilled jobs, but also generated increasing innovative capacity in Costa Rica. Another example would be pharmaceutical production in South Africa. So that's one answer is triangles. Second answer is apprenticeships. So in many fields of technology, it turns out that the most effective way of transferring knowledge is not in writing, it's through apprenticeships in which the people interested in getting up to the top level of speed in the relevant art learn by working alongside the people who are operating in the highest technological level. This is a very old technique. You know, it's been used since at least the 16th century to train in technologies. But increasingly now it's employed in the pharmaceutical field. The country that uses it most effectively is Germany. So training in skills in the production of biologics is frequently done and very effectively in German pharmaceutical firms. It also happens to be the way in which knowledge is transferred to doctors. Doctors ordinarily, you know, they go to medical school, but the way you really learn to be a doctor is during a residency, and it's in the form of an apprenticeship. Okay, so why is this relevant to capacity building? It's relevant to capacity building because the second way of building capacity is to have an organized program in which highly promising candidates from enterprises in developing countries go to work alongside their counterparts in Western Europe, the United States, and Japan, and then return. And you have a rotating system of this sort. The advantage of this approach, as opposed to the current forms of technology transfer, is A, they gain access to the highest level of the technology, and B, it doesn't cost the patentees anything. On the contrary, apprenticeship is famous over the centuries because the apprentices help. They're not just learning, they're also doing. So let's be specific about this. Pfizer and Moderna, who have highly sophisticated mRNA platforms, should be taking on as apprentices representatives of companies in developing countries. So the challenge is, well, how do you induce them to do that? Well, there are various levers you could employ. One of them is to use the powers already held by governments that have given grants to these companies to say, look, we gave you billions of dollars to help develop this technology. One of the conditions thereof is you have to maintain an apprenticeship program. Okay, that's one possibility. Another possibility is to stick to the pharmaceutical field for a moment. Many drugs, many pioneering drugs, are now tested in clinical testing in developing countries. You can't engage in a clinical trial in any country, including a developing country, without getting the permission of the relevant government. The relevant government could make, as one of the conditions of permission to run a clinical trial, agreement to run an apprenticeship program of this sort. So you need a lever of some kind, because the firms will not do it without some kind of pressure. It's definitely true of Moderna and Pfizer. So if you combine lever with apprenticeship, you could facilitate capacity building. Anne, did you have another question?
I do have another question, and thanks also for mentioning that part about apprenticeship. I think it was it Peter Lee's document last week that kind of discussed that? I thought that was absolutely fascinating.
Yes.
Really interesting.
Yes.
Approach.
Yep.
So my question was actually going back to something that Peter had talked about with enablement, and it reminded me that I had a question kind of about the history of 112A versus the current state of the statute. So I was surprised to learn in one of the lectures that it sounded like the written description requirement in 112A was traditionally drawn to new matter, whereas now there's also the portion about a patent specification must describe the claimed invention in sufficient detail. And I was just kind of curious as to why, I guess, that change came about. And I know that sometimes there's some crossover between this portion of written description enablement, but they're also considered a separate and distinct requirement at the same time. But I was just kind of fascinated in, I guess, why that came about and maybe any kind of distinctions you could draw from that or articulate about that. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a very good question. It's a very technical question, but it has quite broad implications. So my speculation, I can't say this with a great deal of confidence, is that this is a manifestation of path dependency, that a Federal Circuit panel deviated from the original understanding of the written description requirement and deployed it as a variant of definiteness rather than as a mechanism to ensure that the patentee actually had control over the relevant technology on the date at issue. In other words, there was just a little bit of a fork in a misuse, that's my view, of written description. But having made the fork, it then produced a line of precedent generated by the serendipity of panel decisions in the Federal Circuit. Had there been, at the inception of this fork, a en banc review of the merits of this particular doctrinal innovation, most likely it would have been rejected and should have been rejected, but it didn't. And so the fork, once it begins, acquires a life of its own. So it's path dependency. But as I say, that's just a speculation on my part. I can't say this with a great deal of confidence, but if it's true, it does have a general institutional implication, which is that the Federal Circuit should be using on-bank review earlier and more often than it currently does. And to avoid getting itself in a pickle, pickles exemplified written description, but also exemplified by the American Axle case, in which now the Federal Circuit is in a complete bind concerning the interpretation of Section 101. Should have taken up the issue a long time ago.
Yeah, thank you. That's really fascinating. I could see how that on-bank decision would would help to alleviate this kind of, or, you know, like you said, eliminate that fork very early on, and how helpful that could be. So, yeah, thank you.
Welcome. Okay, so we're nearing the end, so I want to make sure everybody has a chance to speak here. So I think, Prince, you haven't had a chance yet.
Hello, thank you very much, Prof. Yeah, my question is simple. I read Peter Lee's article on lessons from COVID-19, and I realized the difficulty that other companies are facing in terms of manufacturing of COVID-19 and medicines, simply because some of the originators of COVID-19, I mean, vaccines, have refused to disclose the tacit knowledge, or, I mean, with the pretext that it forms part of their trade secrets. And because of this, it's becoming difficult, although they have disclosed the latent knowledge, but then the tacit knowledge is not being disclosed. Per your experience, what do you suggest are some of the things that can be done to sort of prevent this scenario going forward? Thank you.
Yeah, this is a very important general question. It's actually one of the central concerns of this entire course. One of my suggestions on this front, I already put on the table a few minutes ago, namely the use of levers like the capacity of governments to deny permission to engage in clinical testing to force pharmaceutical firms in particular to run apprenticeship programs that would have the effect of transferring that knowledge to developing countries. Okay, that's one possibility. Another possibility is to encourage, or force if necessary, voluntary licensing. So an example here would be Aspen in South Africa is one of the most effective and skilled practitioners of new technologies with respect to pharmaceutical products. How did Aspen get those skills? Well, one of the ways was some major pharmaceutical firms, here Gilead would be the pioneer, entered into license agreements to not just authorize Aspen to manufacture and distribute, in this case, HIV drugs, but also to transfer to them the relevant technologies. And it worked. It worked both to build the capacity, manufacturing capacity in South Africa, and to get the drugs to the residents of all of sub-Saharan Africa at affordable prices. Now, that hasn't happened yet, as you point out, with respect to the COVID vaccines, or at least with respect to the most medically promising the COVID vaccines, the mRNA vaccines. So we have to figure out some way to push harder to induce Moderna and Pfizer to behave the way that Gilead did with respect to HIV. So when we get to week 8, you will be watching a recorded lecture from the two executives who were responsible for the HIV voluntary licensing programs in India, Pakistan, and South Africa. And they've got some ideas for how to generalize this with respect to the COVID vaccines. So there are going to be more ideas along this front coming up later in the course, but that's a preliminary set of proposals for how to achieve the outcome that you identified. I think we have time for just one more question. Alina, you have not had a chance yet.
Good morning. Thank you. Thank you so much, Professor. I'd like to know your opinion about the use of the flexibilities, TRIPS flexibilities, and in general, the explosion of, in the patent regime. According to the eco-friendly technology, clean technology, as you know, there are many discussions on this issue, the relation between patents and the access to clean technology, to green technology. We have WIPO Green Initiative and other, the discussion in the TRIPS Council, the possibility to have a Doha declaration about climate change and TRIPS flexibility. But I'd like to know your opinion in this case. It's important to have a special regime, or it's enough that according to our patent law, our flexibility, our regimes, I like to know your opinion. Thank you so much, Professor.
Yeah, great question. Okay, so the TRIPS flexibilities is a list of the aspects of patent law that the TRIPS agreement leaves either overtly or implicitly up to the discretion of each country. That's what the flexibilities mean, meaning it's a zone of freedom left to individual countries. My view, as is probably already apparent from this course, is that each country should be using those flexibilities to protect its own citizens, to advance its own economic and social. But it's not always the case that the obvious flexibilities are the best ones. I'll give you an example. Is the most famous of the flexibilities is the freedom to engage in compulsory licensing. For reasons that we're going to see later in the course, this has not worked out terribly well in practice. And my view is that compulsory licensing definitely remains a tool in the toolkit that should be preserved, but primarily for the purposes of facilitating bargaining rather than exercising compulsory licensing. So by contrast, a option available to countries that it's much less well known could be much more effective. And that's the freedom to adjust the availability of patent remedies. So to be a little bit more concrete about this, if a country denied injunctive relief to patentees when important social interests were at stake, like health emergencies, and instead required local enterprises only to pay a reasonable royalty fee, you would radically expand the availability of essential medicines. So that's a trait of flexibility that is not yet widely known and should be much more widely known and used. Okay, so those are just two illustrations of the general proposition. The general proposition is the flexibilities are very important, and each country, in my view, should be using the powers that it enjoys to advance within the boundaries permitted by TRIPS, its own economic interests. But that the most famous of the flexibilities, like compulsory licensing, are not necessarily the optimal ones. And there are others that are less well known that can be used to greater effect.
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, so this has been yet again a very interesting discussion. We're out of time, so I will, as before, complete the recording process and figure out a convenient way to post the recordings for those that couldn't be here. Hope to see you. Many of you again in a week.
Thank you, Professor.
Bye, Professor.
Thank you, Professor.
Thank you, Professor.
Thank you, Professor.